And we're back. Thanks for staying tuned to WVFF 97.7 FM and now more true crime in the Lowcountry.
You have all this information, all right?
Yeah. So does the state.
Yeah.
So does the defense.
And that should have been available during discovery, correct? Elaine?
It was.
All right.
Yeah.
It was available.
So my question is, was this just a sloppy defense? Was this the worst defense that he could have picked?
Let's not speculate, because it's possible. Just think about this.
Why did the defense
gave the defense accurate information, and then at trial, they fudged the numbers. You see, maybe the defense wasn't expecting the prosecution to do what they did at trial, because the documents that the prosecution had given the defense were accurate. So that these inconsistencies aren't reflected in the documents they had. They're reflected instead in the live testimony during the trial.
Well, why didn't the defense recognize that what he said in trial was different than the information that was given in discovery?
Because they're human beings and they're dumb.
Because okay. it was a sloppy defense. That's why.
Well,
Harpootlian was way past his prime.
You just heard this. I wrote this down. Now, during the trial, they're not writing this stuff down. I've been writing down. We are now eight pages into notes till Jim started talking, because it's really important. What he's saying is really precise and important. But I guarantee you that if we had to go to trial 2 weeks from now, right now, in this moment, I have a clear memory of these discrepancies. And as long as Jim was sitting right there, this is why they need Jim. Somebody that's sitting right there that would have said at trial, this is wrong, he's testifying wrong. And then you would have had the defense saying, Your Honor, I object. This is not evidence that's in testimony in the record. In fact, it contradicts evidence. Because he is stating facts. He's testifying to facts, not in evidence. And so we need to have a conference and have this testimony stricken, because here's what the actual numbers are. Now, I agree with you. The defense, as far as I know, did not do that. This, by the way, is not an issue raised on appeal, so I guess they're just going to let this one go. But I wonder how often at trials this kind of stuff happens. Because if you don't have really sharp attorneys representing you, they don't pick up on this. They just don't. And, you know, data was flying during, you know, day after day after day. And think about it. You're an attorney and you're thinking about, I got to go to the bathroom, I need a cup of coffee, what am I going to have for lunch? I wore the wrong suit. I don't feel like being here. You know, whatever. You know, they're distracted by reality, and so they probably just, I mean, it's possible. It's just a combination of being not particularly bright to start with, and that they missed it. They missed it. Would you, Jim, do you think you would, in a week, remember this with specificity so that if somebody were restating it, you would remember that those numbers are wrong? Because we're talking about seconds here, really.
We are talking about seconds. Yeah. No, it's a lot of data to remember.
Yeah. See, because I have a brain that oftentimes is able to attend to this, but you have, these are data points. The larger overarching issue here, they should have picked up on exactly. Which should have made them go back and question the data points. Because, by the way, this is not the first time that any attorney in any case has misquoted numbers. And what they're going to say is, excuse me, Your Honor, it was just an error. It was just a little bit. And cumulatively,
well, that's why Radulski said the word estimate.
I agree. Just to cover his butt. But those little bits add up to Alec could not be the murderer. So that these little bits are incredibly important. Because it's exculpatory evidence if it was viewed accurately. Of course, there is the possibility, Jim, that you've got the data wrong. Just a thought. Don't get mad. But anyway, I agree.
Well, my data's coming from the state, so if it's wrong, then the state's wrong.
Oh, boy.
My math isn't wrong. I did that math 5 different ways.
Okay, and I actually trust you. I wouldn't be doing content with you if I didn't trust you to be able to analyze this data correctly. So,
yeah.
Can I ask you, did you contact the defense about this? Would you contact the defense
I've contacted the defense. They don't respond, and I don't blame them. I mean, I'm sure they got everybody and their brother sending them emails with information and whatever. I did it once or twice. I just stopped.
All right, but, listen. I got to give you an opinion. Alex Murdoch was a victim of his own sick society that he lived in. All right? Where Dick Harpootlian, prominent Democrat, was his buddy, all right? And he thought that because Harpootlian was a sitting state senator, that he would have more influence than he did in the case. And then the state got very, very energetic about the prosecution, which he never expected, all right? And he had a second-class lawyer, all right, who was way past his prime, all right, and may have been able to wield more political power than he ever was any legal acumen, and he screwed up. He had a lawyer. He had a lawyer in a system.
Remember, Frank, he originally hired Dick and Jim to defend Paul, and he paid them around $600,000 to do that. So when Paul died, he just took that and said, just use that money to help defend me, and, you know, whatever I owe you, let me know the difference. So that's what happened.
Now, Harpootlian, in the defense of Paul, might have been a very effective attorney because he had the political clout to work within the system. But when the state aggressively prosecuted Alex for whatever reason, all right, Harpootlian was out of his was out of his realm. He couldn't.
I agree.
You know.
I agree.
No, yeah. Don't say that. Come on.
I think some version of that is absolutely true. The other one is Dick isn't getting any younger, and maybe he had. You know, I've talked to people, attorneys that worked with him, that knew him for years, and say he was brilliant. He was very highly regarded. He had a reputation. He was a brilliant attorney. So maybe he, you know, I know this. I've known attorneys that are brilliant. They rely on their ability to think fast on their feet and win a case. And as you get older and that brilliance fades, and you go from being a superstar to just being a regular human being, your ability to think fast on your feet isn't there. It's not a talent you have anymore. And I do think that during the trial, there were times when Dick would stop questioning the witness before the witness had reached the finish line, or, you know, he hadn't quite summarized the importance of what the witness had just said. It felt like Dick would sit down like, well, okay, we're done with that. And I think, no, Dick, you haven't finished making the point. You never got to the point. And so, I don't know. You know, what's kind of...
Yeah, that happened a lot.
I think it did. I really do. So, I kind of like that we can sort of point to specifically factual things that are wrong, because it's not mythological why this happened. Part of it is just human frailty and human error that sort of sadly all coincidentally colluded to, you know, to convict Alex Murdoch.
Yeah, so here's the other thing. You remember the state going through every single tiny little movement Maggie's phone made?
Yes.
Orientation, yes. Change from this, orientation that, from that, moving, steps, walking, all this stuff. Except 90620. Now, 90620, they just said her phone just went from portrait to landscape. Well, okay. Now, here's what I'm going to tell you. If a phone is picked up and thrown out of a window to the ground in a moving vehicle, whether it's the real killers, which I believe, or Alex's, there are a number of movements that's going to register if it's thrown out of a moving vehicle.
All right, here's a question. If you were going to throw a phone, would you throw it like a Frisbee? which would mean it was in landscape, or would you throw it like a boomerang, which means it would have been in portrait?
Frisbee.
I might do one of both. I don't know.
No, Frisbee. Yeah. If you're going to win.
Okay, let's see. You know, Frank, that's like the guy that threw the phone around the room. I can't remember his name. And I don't know. You'd have to have some studies about that. But anyway, so Jim, what are you going to say? Keep going.
Well, what I'm going to say is that a phone is going to make anywhere from 5 to 15 distinct orientation changes and several impact detections, depending on the sensitivity of the sensors. And it's going to take the orientation change, which it did, but it's also going to have impact movements. It certainly must have bounced, because if Alec threw it, he's going 42 miles an hour. If somebody else threw it, they're at least going that or faster. So it's going to make it could have tumbled. So what I'm saying is there's a lot of movements after 906.20 that her phone likely made that the state did not tell you that they made, even though they told. Remember, I told you this before, when I look at a lot of things that people say, but I also look at what they don't say.
Yes.
And what the all the state said was that 906.20, it went to port, or went to orientation, went to landscape. And that's it. It stops. They don't say any more. Well, that's not true, because the phone would have been making all kinds of things. The gyroscope would have been going crazy on this thing. It just recorded all kinds of movements, and the state didn't tell you anything that it made after 906.20.
Jim, you're looking at data right now, and you know. Wait a minute, Jim. You're looking at data right now, and you know, as a fact, that. At 906.20, that phone was making all kinds of other data that the state just, that's a lie of omission, by the way. The state just didn't let the jury know that, but that the defense could have said, hey, there's other data here, kind of thing.
If they had it.
Do you know that they had data, that after 906.20 there was data?
Well, I don't know that, but what I know is the phone is going to keep recording.
Yeah.
What have they thought?
But we have
what have they thought?
We have no data that it was.
We just have to assume, reasonably assume that it was. Yeah.
Let me put it to you this way. If her phone makes erratic, records erratic, I don't know what you want to call it, movements. Okay, erratic movements at 906.20. That means that's when it was thrown out the window on the side of Moselle. That does not help the state.
I got that point.
That information would exonerate Alex Murdoch, because his phone was still over at the main house. He was still walking while her phone was not recording steps. Her phone was recording movements, and then, you know, I'm telling you, go 42 miles an hour and throw an iPhone out the window and extract that data. You're going to get all kinds of information what that phone did from the time it left your hand. The state.
Can I ask you, was the phone, wouldn't throwing the phone from a vehicle moving at 42, I'm not going to, you know, I have the same kind of phone.
It's not going to record steps.
Okay, but listen to me. Wouldn't it just obliterate the phone? Wouldn't the phone crash and break and fracture and crack? And wouldn't it have been obvious when they found Maggie's phone, you'd have at least a perception of how fast the vehicle had to be going when they threw it? I mean, I'm surprised that the phone was even intact at all if I threw it from the vehicle. How'd that happen? To me, that sort of suggests that whoever was driving wasn't going very fast. Because I think, you know, rather than that guy that threw the phone around the room in his office, somebody should have been throwing 20 phones out the window at 42 miles an hour. Once we knew exactly how fast Alex Murdoch was going, let's just throw an iPhone and see if at that speed, in that location, does it survive intact? I don't think it does.
Funny you mention that, because it segues right into what I'm going to talk about next, which is Alec Murdoch.
I try to help as often as possible.
Yeah, Alec Murdoch enters Moselle Road at 908 36. And that is according, again, SLED, that is according to the GM OnStar, that he enters the road at 908.36. At 908.58, he sends the iMessage, so he pushes the button at 908.58. And he pushes the button, he's right near her, where her phone is, going to check on M, be right back. And M is spelled E-M, and right is spelled R-I-T-E. R-I-T-E. So it's not done by voice-to-text, because voice-to-text would have it spelled correctly. He spelled those words out. And it, the distance between 90, or the time between 908.36 and 908.58 is 22 seconds. What I can tell you, for a fact, because I did it over 20 times in several days, is I drove that entrance, from the entrance to where Maggie's phone was found, and I know where Maggie's phone was found because I saw it on GPS. I went to the spot. It's right next to Godley Farms. There's still, like, woods that are there. In fact, that little orange marker they said was there the first time I went, it was still there. So I know where it is. And in 22 seconds, getting my truck up to 42 miles an hour from the main entrance, I could not, stone sober during the day, better eyesight than him. I didn't kill my wife and son, and I wasn't high on 60 to 80 milligrams of Oxycontin. I was not able to write the words, going to check on M, be right back, hit send, drop my phone, pick up another phone, and throw it out the window. Now, I wasn't using a phone at the time, but I was trying to simulate doing that, and every single time, what I could do was type out the text and hit send. But by the time I hit send, I was already past where her phone was. So then I have to grab something and throw it out the window. Now, somebody had said, well, maybe he wrote it before he got on the Moselle Road. Well, that would be true. But you remember, your phone records everything, and his phone recorded that he didn't start typing until he got on the Moselle Road. It's impossible. And Agent,
so there we go.
Shame on you. You should have went out there and tried to replicate this. Because they said, and what did he do after he sent it? Well, he sped up. Oh, he sped up. He tried to speed away. Okay, he went from 42 miles an hour to 45. I'm sorry, but that's not even negligible on your foot to know what the difference is. Like, it's just impossible. There's just so many things. One, that he didn't have her phone when he was trying to call her. Someone else had her phone. Someone else had her phone in a moving vehicle. And her phone recorded something after it was 906.20 when it went to landscape. But SLED never said what those were, and they're not releasing that via FOIA. Because it's going to exonerate Alex Murdoch. I'm telling you, people, keep telling me I'm wrong. Keep telling me that I don't know what I'm doing. Keep saying that I'm not trained in this. I just keep saying it because you're all wrong. Because these are the facts presented by the state, and this is what facts are. I'm sorry. If you don't like the facts, you're entitled to your own opinion, not your own facts. And the facts are, Alex Murdoch did not have Maggie Murdoch's phone in his hand when he was making those phone calls. It was in somebody else's vehicle.
I agree. I totally agree. I don't know who is giving you this pushback, but they're a bunch of idiots, you know, because... Okay, but here's something else. Don't we all... I mean, you have no vested interest in whether he's innocent or guilty. You're just looking at facts. We're just looking at facts.
I'm just
Frank
looking at
has
facts.
No vested interest. Yeah. So why do people get so upset about a narrative? I think it's because it threatens this monetization of a narrative that is actually easily disprovable if you take the time to look at the facts. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
But, you know, we see lots of evidence of that as humans. We don't do that.
Right.
Well, you guys, it is now 11:32.
No, I'm looking. We're 52 minutes in. We got about 8 minutes.
Well, I was going to say, I imagine that too, but none of this was raised in his appeal, but it should be very important in the next trial that, regardless of what the prosecution presents, Alex's defense should be ready to refute it if they get it wrong, or to hammer it into the jury to get it right. This is exculpatory evidence.
Elaine, what's the basis? What's the basis of his retrial? What's the contention?
Oh, for God's sake, Frank. Okay, Alec is entitled to a new trial because, one, Rebecca Hill tampered with the jury, and so he has a constitutional right to have a trial where no state actor, including the clerk of the court, is tampering with the jury. As simple as that. There's also error in Newman admitting evidence that is that should not have been admitted. But what the defense picks up in the appeal is the evidence of that guy throwing the phone around the room, which is key. We could talk about that maybe next week or whatever, but that's also key exculpatory evidence that is slightly different than what Jim is talking about. But it has to do with this. The state did not even request from GM the accurate data that they had from the vehicle, because what they said basically is we just assumed that GM wouldn't provide it. So we tried to duplicate. They spent a year, these people with, I think we could say, have, you know, with marginal intelligence or capability or competence, they spent a year trying to replicate it or discover it some other way. And during trial, when the state's witness said, we didn't even approach GM because it's just that difficult, GM, on its own initiative, provided the evidence to first the prosecution, who then provided it to the defense. So this information that's accurate about the vehicle, it's also exculpatory, you know, when you put it in the context that Jim just did. It was new at trial, where this time around, it won't be new at trial. It'll be an integral part of his defense. You know what you've done, Jim, though, is you have chipped away at all the credible evidence that the state could probably, you know, possibly use to retry him. I think their case was weak to start with. I think without the media mania, media was hysterical and, frankly, just lazy, sloppy, and wrong in making the public believe that there was no defense, that Alec was this horrible murderer. And in the sober light of day, there isn't enough evidence even to bring him to trial again. By the way, I haven't paid any attention because I've been busy, but has the state filed their response to his appellate brief?
They have not. They have not filed anything yet. And they're probably going to ask for a continuance, and they'll probably get it.
Well, you know what I think, though, is I know, because I did this, you tend to wait to the last second. You have 30 days, and you file it on day 29, 10 minutes in, you know, 10 minutes out from the deadline. So I don't remember when the clock started ticking. I don't remember if they had 15 days to respond or 30 days. I think the state's move here should be 30. To say we don't oppose a second trial. It was at 30? Okay, but they should say we don't oppose a second trial because they're going to get reversed on appeal eventually anyway. Let's just go to trial again. And as you pointed out, and I think this is true, I don't know that there's even the will. I think a different, you know, with a different Department of Justice and absent this frenzy that really doesn't make any sense any way you look at it, I don't even know if they would be trying. But what I would like to see happen instead is the real killers get found, and either they admit to it or there's incontrovertible evidence of their guilt, and he is not just, I'd like to see the real killers caught. And I'm guessing that at this point, maybe you feel about the same. Because that's the ending that Alec needs. Not to be exonerated at the second trial, not to have that conviction reversed, but to have the real killers found and have it not even be in dispute that they're the real killers.
All right, guys,
not in dispute is Alec didn't have her phone. Another living person had Maggie's phone when he was making those calls, especially at 9:06:14. It wasn't him. So if it wasn't him,
all right, I'm convinced. You've convinced me of that. Where do we go? Where do we go from here?
Well, just two things. Nautilus sued Alec Murdoch. He didn't put up a defense. He just said, I can't put up a defense, can't afford one. So they won a judgment of 14 points, I don't know, $6 or $8 million against him. And Corey Fleming, just yesterday, a jury found Corey Fleming liable for the role in Alex Murdaugh's fraudulent insurance scheme, and he was ordered to pay $1.25 million in actual damages. The weird part about that is that they gave him a punitive damage of $50. But anyway, the Nautilus thing is now put to bed. Corey and Alec have been found guilty, and together it's $14, $15, almost $16 million.
And will Nautilus ever see a dime?
$10 million of that is interest on it and damages from it. Because the actual amount, actually all Nautilus ever paid out was $3.8 million.
All right, but will Nautilus ever see a dime?
I don't know about Corey, but they're not going to see a dime from Alec. He's broke. He does have like a $5 million trust, but it's in the trust, so they can't touch it. But he has no money.
Don't you feel sorry for insurance companies when they're for insurance? Because you see, as much as I understand Nautilus finally waking up and saying, "Hey, man," I think that I'm surprised they didn't include John Grantland in their suit, and they dropped the ball on that. They dropped the ball. They could have said right away, "Wait a minute, this check should never have gone to Musk and Fleming. It should have gone directly to Forge." And none of this would have happened if they just followed that much of the procedure. And they had specifically sent an email to Chad Westendorf, who was the personal representative for the estate of Gloria Satterfield at that time, saying this check cannot go to Musk and Fleming. It has to go to Forge, directly to Forge. And even when they sent the check to Musk and Fleming, they said, don't deposit this check or disperse these funds until there is an order signed and filed by the probate judge. Well, that order from Carmen Mullen was never filed at all. So who dropped the ball on following through on that? The law firm representing Nautilus, which was Grantland, Murphy Grantland.
All right, come on. Now I'm going to end this on a humorous note. Yeah, there's some humor here. Carmen Mullins. I was a candidate for a jury that was going to be... heard by Carmen Mullins. And she said, well, when I got disqualified, she asked me, well, wouldn't you like me to spend a couple of days with me? I said, no. How's that for trying to keep a juror?
Frank would not touch on that with a 10-foot pole because she is so well connected in the state of South Carolina. We're not even going to comment on that, right?
A little bit of humor.
Yeah, it is funny. It is funny. I think it's hysterical.
Now, where do we want to go from here? Come on.
Yeah. It's got to be news. We can't anticipate what news is going to be.
Jim, get to work. Get to work. And if we don't have Elaine here next week because she's in jail or something, you got to be able to do something that you're liable for.
Wait a minute. I don't have any expectation of being in jail. What do you know that I don't know?
We won't talk about it.
You're implying something, Frank, that I don't quite... I object.
Overruled.
I got to bounce out of here.
All right,
There's a lot to talk about. The Supreme Court dropped a FOIA bomb on accountability in South Carolina. There's an execution coming up on January 31st in the state of South Carolina.
Oh, Jim, I forgot all about that. You're the execution king.
Yeah.
Oh,
there's an execution coming up.
No.
And there's a Greenville County murder case set to begin on Monday. It's the one of Christina Parcell. They call it the Cane Break murder. I don't know. That was a big one. Back in 2021.
Get a thumbnail sketch of the execution. Who are they going to execute? Wait a minute, Biden exonerated a lot of people on death row or reduced their, you know, their sentence from execution.
Biden commuted the death sentence of a guy in South Carolina who murdered two bank employees. He was robbing a bank. He murdered two women down in Conway, South Carolina. He was in the prison in somewhere in Indiana where they do all the execution stuff, but his sentence was commuted to life. This guy's name is Marion Bauman Jr. He's set to be executed on January 31st after the state of South Carolina so nicely took a holiday reprieve from executions. Just, you know, give people the chance to enjoy a good holiday before they get to pick whether they want to die by firing squad electrocution Yeah, I mean,
you guys are out of control. You're out of control at this point. All right, listen. Next week is next week. Jim, Elaine, bring me some good content. And you're listening to WVFF 97.7 LPFM, Red Brick Patriot Radio. This has been True Crime in the Low Country with Jim Kask and Elaine Greenwood. And folks, I'm out of here. We'll be in touch during the week. Ciao.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that's all the time we have for now on True Crime in the Low Country. We hope you've enjoyed our in-depth coverage of the Murdaugh murder trial so far. Don't worry, we'll be back soon to dive even deeper into the case and bring you more chilling stories from the Low Country region. We thank you for listening to Veterans for Freedom Radio, the Truth in Broadcasting Corporation.